This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. Welcome back to the Relic Radio Show. I've got another 60 minutes of radio drama for you this week, beginning with Theater 5. We'll hear their March 22nd, 1965 episode titled Bad News for Mrs. Bristol. After that, it's The Glass Eye from Favorite Story, their episode from January 1st, 1949.
Theater 5 presents Bad News for Mrs. Bristol. Where's my gorgeous bride?
Back in the kitchen, Paul. You want me?
Yeah, I sure do. When you hear your master's voice, I expect you to come running.
Here I come, master. Oh, are you going out?
Yeah, I have to bid on a batch of secondhand books.
Mm.
How about a kiss for luck? Wow. Now I'll probably pay too much for the books.
You better not. There's a grocery bill that needs paying. What time will you be back, Paul? I'll have dinner ready.
Oh, about 6. Take good care of the shop, will you? And if any customers wander in looking for books, don't let them get away without buying.
Don't you worry. If necessary, I'll chain them to the radiator.
Yeah, but you would at that. So long, sweetie.
Bye, honey.
Oh, doggone it, I forgot something.
What?
Another kiss.
Oh, Paul Bristol, you get out of here.
Hey, quit pushing.
How do you do, sir? May I help you?
Possibly. This bookshop's rather new, isn't it?
Yes, it was opened just about 3 weeks ago.
I'm told the owner is Paul Bristol, that right?
Yes, my husband. I'm Ella Bristol.
I see. Is your husband here?
No, I'm sorry. He went to pick up some books.
What time do you expect him back?
Well, he said he'd be home by 6.
Home?
Yes. You see, we have a small apartment back there behind the shop. But now it's almost 6:30 and I'm getting a little worried. A bride's anxiety, I guess.
You're newlyweds.
Well, sort of. Paul and I have been married 2 months. I don't know our stock too well, but perhaps I can help you. Is there any particular book you're interested in?
No. I'm not a customer. I'm a detective.
Oh?
Sergeant John Belshaw. I'd like to talk to you about your husband.
You... What's happened to Paul? Is he hurt?
Not that I know of.
Well, then what is it? Tell me.
I'd like you to look at a photograph. Yeah. Is this man your husband?
Yes. This is Paul. Where did you get him?
How long have you known him?
A little less than a year, but why do
you... Where did you meet him?
At a dance in town hall. But look, you've got to tell
me
what...
Has he ever told you anything about himself or about his life before you met him?
Well, no, nothing specific. Sergeant Belshaw, why did you come here? Why all these questions about Paul?
Mrs. Bristol, I think you'd better sit down.
Why? Why?
This photograph is a police picture.
A police picture? Of Paul?
It's hard to tell you this, but your husband's real name is not Paul Bristol.
What?
It's Matthew Baker. And Matthew Baker is wanted by the police. 16 months ago in Michigan, he escaped from a hospital for the criminally insane.
I don't believe you.
6 years ago, he strangled his wife in a bathtub full of water.
Oh.
He pleaded not guilty, was declared insane, and imprisoned in the hospital.
But my husband isn't insane. He's as normal as you are.
Did he ever mention having been married before?
No. If he had been, he would have told me. Well, don't you see? You have the wrong man.
No, we have definite proof.
Well, but when Paul comes back, he'll prove that you're wrong.
I doubt that he'll come back.
Why do you say that?
I think he suspected the shop was being watched. That's why he hasn't returned. I also think he'll try to see you or phone you before attempting to leave town. He may even suggest your meeting him and running away with him.
And if I do meet him?
Agree with everything he tells you. Then tell me.
Well, do you realize what you're doing? You're asking me to trap my husband.
But for your own safety. The man's insane and a killer.
I don't believe it. And I won't do it. I won't. Paul is innocent and perfectly sane. And I love him.
Please listen to me. We're sure to catch Matthew Baker. This town and the whole county are covered. He hasn't a chance of getting away. If he's cornered, he'll put up a fight. An officer may be killed, or he may be killed. You're the only one who can keep that from happening. If you can get him to surrender, you can save his life. So what about it? Will you help?
Oh, I don't know what to do. I can't think.
Well, make up your mind, ma'am. There isn't much time.
But I'm Paul's wife. How could you expect me to...
Answer it.
But it might be Paul.
Right. Now, what have you decided?
Well, I don't know.
Well, go on. Answer it.
Hello?
Ella, this is Paul.
Yes?
Don't mention my name. Are you alone?
I said,
are you alone?
Yes, I'm alone.
Now, listen carefully. This is important. I want you to meet me.
Meet you? Where?
Walk down to Maple Street and stand in front of the school.
When?
Right now. Wait there till I come. Understand, Ella?
Yes, I understand.
I love you, sweetheart. Remember that. No matter what happens, I love you.
Paul, I love you too.
Is he gone?
Yes.
When and where does he want you to meet him?
Right now, on Maple Street, in front of the school. I'm to wait till he comes.
Okay. I'll leave the shop first and you follow in a minute or two. And don't be afraid. The police won't be far away.
You won't hurt him. Promise you won't hurt him.
We'll try not to. I promise you that. When you talk to him, tell him the police are all around. We'll move right in. You're a fine girl, Mrs. Baker. I'll see you shortly.
Oh, Paul. Paul. Please try to forgive me. Yes?
It's Paul again. You weren't alone before. I could tell by your voice. What about now?
I'm alone, darling. But listen...
Wait, there isn't time. I've got a new plan.
You're not going to the school?
No, but you go. Just as I told you to.
What?
Wait there for about half an hour. Then go back to the shop.
But aren't you going to meet me at all?
Of course, but later. Now listen, pack a bag and gather up all the cash we've got. Remember our bench in the park?
Yes.
Meet me there as close to midnight as possible. And don't leave by the front door. Go upstairs and walk across the roofs. Come down to the vacant house on the corner, you know, the way the kids do. Understand?
Yes.
Good. Now go to the school and wait. I'll see you in the park at 12. Love me?
Oh, you know I do, Paul.
That's my girl.
Tired out, Mrs. Baker.
Oh, I am tired, Sergeant.
I'm sorry your husband didn't meet you at the school. It would have been all over by this time. Oh,
Paul must have known somehow that the police were watching. Oh, I'm sorry. But you must be worn out yourself. Why don't you leave me now and get some sleep?
Not just yet. He might phone you to explain why he didn't show up.
Oh, I don't think he will.
Would you go away with him if he asked you to?
I don't know.
You still don't believe that he murdered his wife and that he was found insane?
I believe those things happened to a man named Matthew Baker.
A man you know as Paul Bristol. He's not responsible for his actions. If you go away with him, he might do the same thing to you someday.
Paul wouldn't hurt me. I'm not afraid.
Well, as long as you stay inside, you'll be all right. The police will be watching this building all night.
Watching the building?
Yes, we've got men at the front and back.
Oh.
Now, I suggest you go back to your apartment and go to bed.
All right.
If the phone rings, I'll call you to answer it.
Very well, Sergeant. Oh, I think I will go to bed.
Fine. I'll stay here another half hour. If your husband isn't caught during the night, I'll be back early in the morning.
Paul?
Right here, Ella.
Oh, Paul. Paul, hold me.
Later. We've got a lot to talk about.
But won't you kiss me?
Huh? Oh, sure. Now, tell me, did anybody see you going across the roof?
No, but the police are watching the building.
They told you everything about me?
Everything about Matthew Baker.
But you came to me anyway. Why?
I love you, Paul.
Not Paul. Matthew. Matthew Baker.
Oh.
They said I strangled my wife in the bathtub.
Oh.
I escaped from a hospital.
Yes, Paul, they told me all that.
And you still love me?
Well, you're my husband. But I want you to give yourself up.
Give myself up? Why?
We'll fight to have you proven innocent.
Not a chance. They say I'm crazy. But I've proved that I've been able to make a living, that I'm not crazy, but that won't make any difference to them.
It will, Paul. We'll show them that they're wrong, how wrong they are.
Oh, you don't understand, Ella. The only way I can be free is to keep running away.
They'll find you again. No, darling, we must prove that you didn't commit that crime.
I didn't. That's the awful part of it. Somebody broke into the house that night, then got away. But they accused me. Then they put me away in that place.
Oh.
I couldn't stand it, so I got away and changed my name. I couldn't tell you about it.
Paul.
I didn't want you to know, ever. You believe me, don't you?
Yes, Paul.
Tonight, I wish we'd never met each other.
Oh, don't say that. I'll stay with you. I'll fight with you.
It's no use. It's no use. I've got to run away again.
Not without me.
You mean you'd come with me?
Anywhere, Paul.
Oh, my darling.
But how can we get out of town? They're watching.
Well, we won't try right away. Listen, Ella, this afternoon I took a room in a little hotel. We could stay there for a few days. The police can't watch forever. Shall we go there tonight? To the little hotel?
Yes, Paul. Anything you say. Anything at all. Paul, you've been pacing this room since dawn. I wish you'd lie down and rest a little.
I can't rest, Ella. I've got to think of a way to get out of this town.
But last night you said you wouldn't try right away. You're going to stay here in the hotel for a few days until the police stop watching.
They'll never stop watching until I'm dead.
Don't say that. Never say that again.
You don't understand. You've never been hunted.
Oh, Paul, come over here and come and sit beside me.
All right, now what?
Well, let's talk sensibly.
Sensibly? What do you mean by that? You think I haven't been talking sensibly?
Well, of course you have. I only meant...
Or do you think I've been talking like a lunatic?
Paul, no.
That's exactly what you think. You're like all the others. You think I'm out of my mind.
I don't, Paul.
What are you going to do? Huh? Call the police? Turn me in?
No.
You are. I can see it in your face.
Paul.
You're trying to trap me,
now,
Ella.
Paul, calm down.
You've got it all planned.
Paul.
Good Lord, I can't even trust my own wife.
Oh, Paul. Oh, don't. Take your hands away.
What? What did you say?
Oh. Paul, you were choking me.
Ella. Ella, forgive me.
Go away. Don't come near me.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't realize. Ella, come here.
Don't touch me. There is something wrong with you, Paul. There is.
No, I didn't mean it. I couldn't help it. All of a sudden, my head seemed...
Yes, I know. Get away.
Gosh. Darling, I just realized. We haven't had any breakfast.
Oh, that's right. Paul, we need food. Go get me something to eat.
I will. There's probably a dining room
downstairs. Oh, yes, I'm sure there is.
I don't know how I could have forgotten that. Now, you wait right here,
oh,
sweetheart.
Yes.
And I'll be back in a few minutes.
Oh, dear God. Listen, this is room 204. You've got to help me.
You crazy fool, what are you doing?
Paul.
I heard you. You were calling the police.
No, I wasn't.
Liar! You hypocrite! You Judas! You were turning me in!
Thank you. Listen, who do I talk to about that Matthew Baker, you know, the one in the newspaper?
You got some information?
Yeah, I think so.
Now, hold on. I'll give you homicide. Homicide, Sergeant Belshaw.
Hey, look, this is Al Harris, manager of the Diamond Hotel. Yeah, you know this Baker, the one they call a mad killer?
What about him, Mr. Harris?
I think he's upstairs in the hotel, him and his wife.
What makes you think so?
Well, the switchboard buzzed just now, and when I plugged in for room 204, the lady called for help. And she stopped and dropped the phone. Sounded like somebody put a hand over her mouth.
Go on, what else?
Well, they left the phone off, see? Then when I listened, I hear them yelling to one another. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think you better come down here and check it out.
I'll be there in 5 minutes. Keep listening to room 204.
Admit it, Ella. You were trying to betray me, weren't you?
No, Paul. I was trying to help you.
By turning me over to the police?
Yes. There is something wrong with you, Paul. You're a stranger to me, a completely different man. And Paul, I once knew would never have attacked me the way you did.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. All I can say is, please try to forgive me. Will you do that, Ella?
Oh.
And will you go away with me as you promised?
I can't, Paul. Not now. You must go back to that hospital where your sickness, whatever it is, can be cured.
But I'm not sick. I'm not.
Oh, Paul.
You're talking like all those other people. Don't you love me anymore?
I did love you. And I could love you again. But only if you give yourself up. Will you do that, Paul? It's our only hope.
I don't know. I need time to think it over.
Paul, won't you please give me the key so I can unlock the door?
I'm sorry, Ella. I can't hear you.
Paul, what are you doing?
Filling the tub, darling. What does it look like?
Are you Mr. Harris?
Yeah.
Sergeant Belshaw. What's been happening in 204?
Oh, not much for the last couple of minutes.
Is their phone still open?
Yeah, but I don't hear anything right now. So, you know, after I called you, I listened like you told me to. I heard somebody walking up and down, and I could hear it talking, and then I couldn't make out what they were saying. Except one thing. I think they called one another Ella and Paul.
Then it's our man. Paul is Matthew Baker.
Gee, I sure hope nothing's happened to that lady. Wouldn't be so good for the hotel.
Oh, very thoughtful of you.
You know what I mean. Hey, where you going?
Upstairs to 204. Keep listening through your switchboard.
Yes, sir. Hey, wait. Come back.
Well?
Sounds like somebody in 204 just picked up the phone.
You sure? Let me listen.
Hear anything?
Shh. Hello. Anybody on this line?
Yes. Who's speaking?
Are you Matthew Baker?
Who's speaking, I said?
Detective Belshaw in the lobby. You're Baker, right? Is your wife up there with you?
Yes.
Is she alive?
What do you mean, is she alive?
If Ella can speak, put her on.
No. I don't think I can do that.
Okay, Baker, I'm coming up.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Why not?
I'm supposed to be crazy, remember? While you're breaking the door down, anything could happen.
All right, I'll wait here. Open the door and come on down. If you're not on the stairs in 2 minutes... I'm coming up, and don't forget, I've got a gun.
I'm sure you do.
Your wife loves you, so give her a break. 2 minutes, Baker, so make up your mind.
Well, Sergeant, there's your 2 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going up. Stand by the switchboard in case I need you.
Yes, sir. Hey, wait. That's 204 calling.
Give it to me. Belshaw here. You calling me, Baker?
Yes. I've decided. I'm coming down. And you can put your gun away.
Okay. I'll be waiting at the bottom of the stairs. You'd better stand aside, Harris. He's coming down.
The lady, too?
He didn't say. Say a prayer, will you?
Yes, sir. I'll try. Hey, I'm coming, Sergeant.
Is that you, Baker?
Yes, it's me.
Where's Ella?
Who?
Ella, your wife.
Oh. You want Ella? Come on down, sweetheart. There's somebody in the shop.
Yes, Paul. I see him.
Are you all right, ma'am?
Yes. I'm all right.
I'm very glad to see you. Hold out your hands, Baker.
Isn't that funny, Ella? The customer's the mediator.
Yes, Paul. So I see.
All right, Baker. We're ready to go now. Mrs. Baker, there's a squad car for you. You'll follow us down.
Very well. Oh, Sergeant.
Yes?
You will treat him gently, won't you?
Yes, ma'am. I promise.
Theater 5 has presented Bad News for Mrs. Bristol, written by Albert G. Miller, produced and directed by Bill Gately. In the cast, Ann Houston, Ed Zimmerman, Jackson Beck, and Sam Raskin. Audio engineers Marty Folia and Neil Pultz. Sound technician Ed Blaney. Script editor Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Alexander Vlastotsenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. Executive producer for Theater 5, Mr. Lee Bowman. We invite your comments. Write to Theater 5, New York 23, New York. This is Fred Foy speaking. Has been an ABC Radio Network production.
This is Ronald Coleman inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story. Favorite Story invites you to hear a story discovery. It was found on a London bookstall by Jerome Robbins, the young choreographer who did such brilliant work in the Broadway hits On the Town, High Button Shoes, and Look Ma, I'm Dancing. Robbins thought this yarn so unusual that he immediately sent us a copy and named it his favorite story. A half dozen cables have sped back and forth across the Atlantic to obtain the rights to dramatize this strange tale. So, for all of you who like your narratives on the startling side, here's John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Things that are funny so that you laugh at them. And there are things that are funny, but you don't laugh at them at all. You can take, for example, the case of Julia. Is it possible to laugh at people like Julia? I've never been able to. Yet Julia is funny. There's something funny in that gaunt shape, in those wide and earnest eyes, and the red, moist tip of that nose of hers that seems longer than any nose in the world. Julia is over 40, 42 to be exact. A friend of mine, a man who makes up verse for the magazines, wrote a poem about Julia. He called it To Julia, a song for a lost mad girl. And it went like this. Oh, she thought she was in China and a million miles away, all among the tall pagodas where the shining geishas play. And the mockingbirds were singing and the lanterns burning red, and the temple bells were ringing softly, softly in her head. Now, Julia isn't really mad, just strange. You'd be strange, too, if you led the life Julia leads. I want you to hear a story about Julia. Since most of what happened is so terribly personal, let's climb the stairs to Julia's dusky little flat and sit down next to her, as if we weren't even there, and try to listen to what goes on inside her head.
It didn't happen. It never happened. I might have imagined it, you know. Yet this room is real enough. The yellow wallpaper stained with damp at the corners. The washstand. The gas ring a trifle rusty. The mantel shelf with the 8-day clock. And in front of it, on a square of velvet, the glass eyes. His glass eyes. As real as anything else in the room. No. I mustn't look at it. I mustn't keep it there as a terrible reminder. Why do I? Why? It's the only memory I have. The only memory. It started late one summer. It was warm in London. I was working for Mr. Mofrey, a solicitor. I remember turning on my stool and waiting until he had finished writing a sentence in a law brief. Mr. Mofrey.
Yes, Miss Benson?
Would you mind, Mr. Mofrey, if I left about 20 minutes early this afternoon?
Oh? What's the special occasion, Miss Benson?
I have to meet a train. My sister's boy is coming to spend a few days with me. They live in Lister.
Oh, yes, that's the crippled lad, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Murphy. My sister likes to spend a bit of time visiting her husband's people in Wales. And so Bernard comes to London. I do my best to show the poor little chap a good time.
That's very generous of you, Miss Benson. What sort of things do you do to amuse the lad?
I take him to the cinema. I buy him a toy. He's a quiet child. He doesn't ask for much.
Hunsaker down the hall mentioned that there was a good bill at the Old Palace Music Hall. I imagine the lad would like that. Acrobats and such. There's also a ventriloquist. One of those chaps who throws his voice.
Oh, that's a fine suggestion, Mr. Mofrey. I'll get tickets for tonight. Thank you very much, Mr. Mofrey. I met Bernard at his train. He was a very pale child, 11 years old. We had supper at the ABC tea shop. A mutton chop apiece and a large baked potato between us. It tasted good. Bernard said very little, but it was good to eat with someone else, with a guest. We went to the theater and sat in red plush stalls. There was an acrobat act, a man and a woman in white tights and spangled panties. I'm afraid I found it rather dull. Now, let me see, Bernard, what's next? Max Collodi, I guess you pronounce it. The gentleman ventriloquist with his amazing dummy, George. Oh, I think this will amuse you, Bernard. The curtain rose, and I saw him.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I and my talented little dummy here will be pleased to entertain you.
Watch out who you're calling a dummy, Max. You're not so smart yourself.
How about a song, George? A nice, smart song.
Don't mind if I do, Max, old man. Isn't he dull?
Go ahead, George.
Stop shoving me, Max. I'm going. There was I, awaiting at the church, awaiting at the church, awaiting at the church. This here girl, she looked.
As he sat there on the stage with the spotlight on him, I knew there was no one more handsome in the whole world than Max Collodi.
His dark hair gleamed, his shoulders were so broad. George, the dummy on his knee, was a grotesque doll about 3 feet high. I hardly listened to their act. I just stared and stared at the incredibly handsome young man. And I knew then that there could be no other man in all the world for me but the ventriloquist, Max Calone. I took Bernard home as if I were in a dream. I gave him a cup of hot milk and put him to bed in a cot behind a curtain. Then I went to bed at the far side of the room. I lay for a long time staring at the ceiling, listening to the night sounds. Footsteps through the window from the street. The slow footsteps of a policeman. The strolling footsteps of lovers. Lovers. Lovers.
Oh, come on. Come on now.
And all the time I kept thinking, Max Calodi. Mrs. Max Calodi. Madame Calodi. Or is it Signora Calodi? Oh, footsteps mounting the stairs. The young man in the flat above coming home. Suppose I was Signora Calodi. Right now, I'm lying in the upper room of our villa in Italy. Max has been appearing at the theater. He's coming home now, dead tired. It's his footsteps coming up the stairs. In another moment, the door will open. He'll come in. He'll lean down and kiss me. I'll hold him very close. It is the young man upstairs. He's going into his flat. Signora Calodi. After Bernard went back to Lystra, I went to the music hall again. I prayed that Max Calodi would still be there. He was. He was. It was his last night. I sat so impatiently through the dreadful acrobat act. And then he came on. He came on. I didn't listen to his act at all. I just stared at him.
A ventriloquist doll am I. A ventriloquist doll, that's all.
And that's all you are, son.
Well, don't rub it in, man. Don't rub it in.
I didn't care what George was. It was Max, his master, I cared about. What a nice small bow he made. Such gentlemanly restraint. Bowing without standing up, with the dummy still on his knee. They were applauding him, my Max. It was impossible to believe that anybody could be so handsome. I had to see him again. I had to know where he was going from here. I bought a copy of Stage. Here it is. Finsbury next week, then Streatham, Bradford, Blackpool. Yes. Yes. I'm going to do it. Mr. Murphy.
Yes, Miss Benson.
I wish to give my notice.
Huh?
I'm needing your service.
Leaving, Miss Benson? Whatever for? Aren't you happy here?
I must be frank with you, Mr. Murphy. I am not. I'm leaving to go with the man I'm in love with. I said that so surely, so certainly, like a young girl. Oh, but I never would have said it. If I knew then what I know now. As I sit here in the room with the yellow wallpaper, looking at that hideous thing on my mantelpiece, the glass eye.
We're ready for Act Two of this week's favorite story. Lurien Tuttle stars as Julia in John Keir Cross's remarkable tale called The Glass Eye. Julia sits in the half-light of her room, hardly daring to look at her mantelpiece. For there, on a square of black velvet, is the glass eye.
Why did I do it? Years of loneliness, solitary meals, an ugly room with yellow wallpaper. No one to love. And then suddenly, Max Collodi. I had a small capital simply invested. I'd accumulated it through many years of saving. I drew it all out. I would live on this and follow Max Collodi around the country. Just looking at him, sitting there so handsome in the spotlight on the stage. Just looking at him was enough. I went to every performance he gave for weeks, paying my 3 shilling 6, sitting in the darkness, looking at the light. But then I felt I had to meet him. Maybe. If I were bold enough, I would even go up to him and say, "Mr. Collodi, I enjoy your performance very much." And perhaps even shake his hand quickly for just a moment. At Strotham, I got up enough courage and waited at the stage entrance in the shadows.
Good night,
You're
Pop.
On performance tonight. Lock those boobs out front on a window, chuckle.
Two little things. Here it is.
I watched them all go out. The acrobat, the fat lady who rode the bicycle in the closing act. The juggler with the funny ears. But no. No Max Collodi. I waited a long time. They started to turn out all the lights. The old man at the stage door started to lock up the theater. I walked up to him slowly.
Who's that?
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm sorry to bother you.
Yes. What do you want?
I know you'll think this is very odd. But can you tell me if Max Collodi has come out yet?
You're waiting for Max Collodi?
Yes.
Well, that's a good one. She's waiting for Max Collodi.
I knew I wasn't good enough for him. People would laugh. I was old, and he was young and handsome. But even so, I wrote Max Collodi a letter. I wrote it very carefully. I told him how much I enjoyed his performance and wondered if perhaps I might be privileged to meet him. Days later, I received a reply. I tore open the letter. "My dear Miss Benson, I am grateful for your praise. I regret to say, however, that I never grant interviews. Cordially yours, Max Collodi." Oh... But I kept going to his performances, and I kept on writing to him. It surprised me very much that he went on replying. And as time passed, he seemed to grow warmer in his letters, even friendly. Once, in Bradford, he asked me to send him a photograph. I found a blurred snapshot of myself. In it, I appeared on a lawn against a background of fuchsia and veronica bushes, very shy, with my head to one side. It was a very old snapshot, a daylight exposure print on matte paper. People had said in those days that it was a dead spit image of me. The bobbed hair caught up in a bandeau of Japanese silk. The frock with no waist that ended above the knee. The earrings of emerald cut glass. But it was a picture of me at 23. I shouldn't have. The whole thing wouldn't have happened if I hadn't sent that picture. It was at Blackpool that I finally met Max Collodi. I'd been suggesting again and again in my letters that someday we might meet. And finally, a letter came. A very special letter. I ripped it open. Dear Miss Benson, I believe that I might grant you a short interview, but we must make certain conditions. You are to stay only for 5 minutes this first time. Later on, perhaps, if you still wish to go on seeing me, we might arrange longer appointments. I wish to state at this time that I have an aversion in real life to strong light, being so much in my professional life under the glare of the lamps and the footlights. So my hotel room will be dimly lit. If you do not mind being received in a half-lit hotel bedroom by a strange man with no other chaperone beside my dummy, George. My. Then would you come to the Seabank Temperance Hotel, Mortimer Street, Blackpool, at 10 p.m. on Saturday evening next, after my show at the Winter Garden Theater. At that time, I will be happy to tell you something about myself. And to hear in return something about you. Oh, I'm going to meet him. I'm going to meet Max Collodi. All day that Saturday I spent in front of the mirror at the boarding house where I was staying. But powder and lip rouge, used discreetly, of course, could not make me look 23 again. All the makeup in the world couldn't keep me from looking 42. I spent hours of agony before I could make up my mind what to wear. In the end, I knew there was no hope of looking like the snapshot. And I blessed Max for suggesting that the room be dim and that the interview last only 5 minutes. At 10 minutes to 10, I was walking up and down in a dark place near his hotel, waiting. It was the longest 10 minutes I had ever spent in my life. I glanced at my watch. 2 minutes to 10. I pushed open the swinging door of the hotel and walked up to the reception desk.
Yes, lady?
Could you tell me the number of Mr. Max Collodi's room, please?
They're number 7 on the first floor. Stairway to your left. Huh.
As I walked across the lobby, I felt his eyes on my back. I mounted the stairs, taking care not to trip over the worn carpet. I dabbed at the tip of my nose with a small scented handkerchief. At a roses from Boots had fallen fixed the bottle. Number 5. Number 6. Number 7.
Come in.
I was sitting behind a large mahogany table. Even in the dim light, I could not mistake him. He was so handsome. He didn't get up. He just inclined his head in the brusque, slightly stiff way I knew so well. It was the bow with which he acknowledged applause in the theater.
Dear lady, pray sit down.
Thank you. I didn't know what to say. What was there to say? To gain time, I quickly glanced around the room. An ordinary room with flowered wallpaper. There was a bed, a wardrobe, a small chest of drawers. Rolled grotesquely on a chair to Max's left was the dummy George. So lifeless there in the half-light. Mr. Collodi.
Max Collodi at your service.
Mr. Collodi. My voice sounded thin and false. Not myself speaking at all, but someone else. Someone else in my body. Trembling. Aching. Sick and stomach. And suddenly this swept into me as I sat there. A terrible and overwhelming desire. I wanted to touch Max Collodi. Just to touch him once. To touch his hands, his forehead, his blue-tinted jaw. It was a craving so terrible I could not resist. I got up. stood for a moment, staring wildly, hardly breathing. I walked quickly around the table.
Madam, what are you doing?
I touched him on the cheek and... He toppled sideways and fell from his chair.
You crazy woman! What have you done? What have you done?
The dummy George was standing up on the chair, his hideous face twisted with rage. And as I stared, I realized that the dummy George was a living creature. And that what I had loved was nothing but wood and claws and glass. At last I had met Max Collodi, the ventriloquist. I stared at the dummy on the floor, the beautiful, staring face I had loved so much. One eye was gone and fodder poured from his head, but it still smiled. And all the time that misshapen dwarf was weeping. That unlovable thing, the real Max Collodi, who had worked the movements of that handsome mouth with strings. And why? How could he have hoped to get away with it? He who was as hungry for affection as I was. I started to run from the room. My foot trod on something round and hard. I stooped and picked it up, then ran screaming from the hotel. It was the glass eye. The glass eye of the thing on the floor. The glass eye that rests now as a terrible relic on its black velvet pants on my mantelpiece.
Now that is a story. Tell me honestly, did you ever think that the real ventriloquist would turn out to be just a dwarf? And that the big handsome man was really only the dummy? Well, it had me surprised. That's what we call a switch ending, and it's the kind that would have made O. Henry proud indeed. Doreen Tuttle is to be warmly congratulated for her fine acting as Julia, and Byron Kane deserves a bow for his portrayal of Max Collodi, both sizes. Claude Sweeten, as always, composed and conducted the music. Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee wrote and directed this pre-radio adaptation of John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Our thanks also to choreographer Jerome Robbins, who chose The Glass Eye as this week's favorite story.
That's it for the Relic Radio Show this week. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find more from Theater 5 Favorite Story, past episodes of this podcast, and all the others at relicradio.com. You'll find our Shoutcast stream there and our donate button if you'd like to help support this and all the shows. My thanks, as always, to those who have, and thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next Tuesday with another episode of the Relic Radio Show.